All right. Well, as I was telling you, I'm feeling like particularly shitty today because I had my premiere cinema going experience last night of the pandemic.
Yeah, which you went to go see Spiral.
I went to see Spiral at a
Spiral,
10.
a Spiral, which I guess we're gonna call, let's call it Chris Rock's Spiral,
Chris
because
Rock Spiral.
he was really the
Very instrumental.
pushing for
It
this.
was his idea. Yes, I went to the 10-10 showing, figuring that very few people
Oh,
would be there,
perfect time.
and I wouldn't get COVID. I just overdid it. I started the night with a large pizza by my which I just housed by myself.
Jesus.
I went to the theater. I was just so excited, I think, to be in a
No,
movie.
that's like it's excitement worthy. It's like it's you know it's you should be excited to go. I haven't been to a theater since Jesus
Before the
Christ, man.
pandemic.
Yeah.
What was your last movie?
Probably the last thing I saw was maybe something like Oscar-ish in like the end of 2019. Have to look through like my archive of like theater stubs. So no idea.
Well, so needless to say, I was excited. So I got myself a
Yeah, of
large tub
course.
of popcorn, a cherry Coke,
Oh God, come on, man. Of
and
course.
Kit Kat balls, which I had never seen before.
Oh, yes.
Yes, but I also
Yes.
like halfway
That
through
is
the
an
movie, I was.
incredible. Well, I'm shocked you didn't throw up.
Yeah, I wasn't feeling
Cuz
hot.
you also said you smoked a huge joint.
I had took a couple puffs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I
But
didn't
still,
like.
that's enough. That's enough to like make you feel like dog shit.
Yeah, I felt like dog shit, but the movie was fun. Welcome to 86 with Brian and Gore. We are here to analyze and dispute the Academy Award nominated films of 1991, representing the movies of 1990. Yeah, the particular year.
Well, this is a funky year because it's not split exactly down the maybe kind of down the middle, but there are two that we love, two that we could give less of a shit about, and one that we're in the middle, I'd say, about. Not necessarily a complete shit show, except for that it totally is. The Oscar nominees from the year 1991, celebrating the films of 1990, go as listed. It starts off with the winner. We'll start off with the winner, Kevin Costner's directorial debut, one of the three films that he's directed. It's Dances with Wolves by Kevin Costner. I had never seen this movie in all my years. I just knew the reputation as the Oscar-winning best picture from 1991 that beat out one, I think two far more deserving films. I'd never seen it before. There's a lot of issues with it. It's a semi-compelling film about the usual like kind of like white man savior thing, whatever. This movie's 3 hours long. It's directed very competently. I will not deny that. Kevin Costner directed this very competently, and I will say competently. I think he was wildly miscast himself as the lead in this. And then the other issue I think goes with the female counterpart, the other like white person who is
Mary McDonald.
Mary McDonald, who is raised by Native Americans. They essentially look like a fucking white snake video. Why Mary McDonald would have this big teased hair instead of having like a traditional native, long hair braided, or they both, it's Kevin Costner, who I don't think is a bad looking guy. I don't hate, I know you got your beef with him. I don't hate him. I kind of just don't mind him. But he, through the course of this movie, gets worse and worse looking. He looks stupider and stupider. At first, he has a big beard. He's like in the Civil War, and then like long hair, and then he just like starts doing shit to himself, and you just start going like, "What the fuck are you doing?" Yeah, it won a lot of shit. It won seven, I believe, seven Academy Awards, and it's one of those ones that you watch now and you go, "What the fuck?" I did it anyway. So we got Dances with Wolves, which is the winner from 1990. Then we have Awakening with Robin Williams, Robert De Niro.
directed by Penny Marshall, based on the Oliver Sacks memoir of the same name. Really, really nice performances from Robert De Niro and Robin
Robin Williams.
Williams, John Hurd.
Oof, one of my absolute faves.
Yeah, Penelope Ann Miller, the wonderful Max von Sydow. It's a nice movie. I mean, it's also maybe a little bit dated and takes place in the Bronx, which I know you appreciate.
I do. I certainly
Yeah,
do. Yeah.
it's a movie. I don't know. It's a fucking movie. Like, it feels like a
Yeah.
movie. It doesn't.
Yeah. It feels like an Oscar nominee.
Yeah.
Okay. Next up, we got Ghost. Very funny to me that Ghost, directed by, I will say, incomparable Jerry Zucker,
Yeah.
who has did, who did Airplane, Top Secret, Police Squad, Ruthless People, First Night, which
Yeah, I
is a
would
little
say
bit
Ghost is
later.
his worst movie.
Well, mind you say that, but I think amongst a
Also,
certain
Rat Race.
subsect of people, I purposely left that one out. Amongst a certain subsect of people, like, Ghost is like his banger.
Yeah, I know. People love
I think
Ghost.
it's
I
just
never
not, I
got
think
it,
it's just
but
not a, like, a thing that
yeah.
appeals to us necessarily. Demi Moore, such a babe at that point. Patrick Swayze, you know how I feel about. He's just incredible. I love, and the genuinely incomparable
Yeah.
queen, Whoopi
Yeah,
Goldberg.
nobody's like her. I love Whoopi too.
Her Oscar winning performance in this, Whoopi forever.
Yeah, she had some steep competition though. Lorraine
She did.
Bracco,
That's on,
Diane
well,
Ladd
okay.
in Wild at Hearts.
Then we got the final two, which are, these guys have been friends for a long time. And it's very much a very funny kind of, where are your careers at? Where we got Francis Ford Coppola with The Godfather 3, and then we have Martin Scorsese with Goodfellas. And I think, obviously, with Francis Ford Coppola, people are gonna say, are their films would be the ones that are like, oh, well, like, that's not your peak, man.
No, not at
Whatever.
all. I like the movie.
But there's no bigger opposite than that. Than like, oh, Martin Scorsese, I'm sorry, man. He, like, you're at your peak. Like, Godfather 3 is better than, like, a lot of movies,
Yeah.
especially made. And then you have Goodfellas, which everybody in the, I don't know, fucking universe just acknowledges is the best. So, in terms of 1990, there were a bunch of really great movies that came out that we think are pretty significant, pretty cool, and important. We're gonna start off with Robert Altman and his. So, we got Robert Altman's offering from 1990, which is Vincent and Theo. Tim Roth as Vincent Van Gogh and the relationship with his brother. It's a very beautiful film. We got Tremors. I know you're a big fan.
It's funny. I looked up Tremors the other day just as a refresher, and one of the first questions asked on Google is Tremors based on a true story? Which I really appreciate.
which of course it would be one of the first questions. We got Hard to Kill, another Steven Seagal banger, in which he is, as per usual, hard to kill. So then next up we got House Party,
Oh, classic.
banger,
Great movie.
starring fucking Kid and fucking Play. Talk about a great time. Directed by the, excuse me, incomparable Reginald Hudlin, who has been a part of so many just cool movies, produced Django, which I'm not a huge fan of, but like just all kinds of different stuff, 90s bangers, just done a shitload of The Last OG, and just like really, I mean, Reginald Hudlin is just, he's really held it up. Kind of in the same vein as we were talking about last time with Robert Townsend, in terms of, just really being exemplary, black filmmaker, producer, pushing stuff in the right way, just great. Next up, we got, oh, something that I watched in preparation for this episode, and I'm very glad I did because I had seen it in movie theaters many times, and I know Jake did as well. I was this costume for, I think, 3, 4 years in a row, and it was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
The premier characters of our childhood, I would say.
Just, I mean, come on, man. Like, talk about fucking holding up. It's just a great, fun adventure, interesting origin story. The last film that Jim Henson himself worked on. He helped figure out all the kind of animatronics for the suits between all the turtles and Master Splinter. It's very emotional that I still remember from when I was, and I watched it again the other day, but remembering Raphael in the bathtub in the like country house, and everybody's like looking after him and the whole thing. Elias Koteas is great in this. It
It's a
really
beautiful film, yeah.
fucking holds up, and it actually is very beautiful. Like, the
It
cinematography is
is.
great.
Feels
It's
like a gritty
very
New York movie.
insanely gritty New York
And they
movie.
take the time though to like tell the story, which I like. Like
Yeah,
it's not
yeah.
all flash in the pan. Like it's
And the origin part is very carefully considered.
good soundtrack.
Great
I
soundtrack.
had the tape.
Yeah, it's a great movie. It's a great movie. It holds up today. They simply don't make them like that. Next up, we got John Waters' offering from 1990, Crybaby, with the incomparable, and I'm gonna mention her first, Ricki Lake,
Oh, love Ricki
and
Lake.
Johnny Depp and Tracy Lords, the Queen.
Patty Hearst is in that shit, man. I mean,
Patty Hearst.
that's a baller move, dude.
Simply a banger. We got Ernest Goes to Jail. Always gonna mention Ernest.
Yeah, that's not the one I remember as well. I remember Ernest Scared Stupid the best.
Scared Stupid's your banger. As far as I'm concerned, because I watched it with her, and this is another kind of banger, but very funny. I Love You to Death. I Love You to Death is great. It's got Kevin Kline, Tracy Ullman, God,
Banger.
William Hurt. Dude,
Okay.
Keanu and River Phoenix are in it. It's great, man. It's a
Yeah, he's
banger.
doing like
It's
a
such
very broad Italian
the
caricature.
broadest. The broadest. It's
Yeah, I've seen
insane.
this.
Just like the Italian Lothario guy, whatever.
Joey Boca.
Yeah, dude, it's so good. That's a really fun one. Next up, we got one of your favorites that I watched because of you, Miami Blues.
So funny.
Miami Blues is
It's
ridiculous.
fucking insane.
Fred Ward
I love him.
is talk about the
What a
definition
year
of
between that and Tremors.
fucking dude, fucking going for
Going so hard with the teeth,
with
man.
the teeth, the teeth. Or the lack thereof, we should say. We're gonna talk about the god Alec Baldwin later because
He
there's a
goes for it
whole
almost harder in this movie than any other thing he's done.
dude, he's in such a zone in this. It's ridiculous.
What was happening there?
Straight out of prison, on a path to death, destruction, chaos,
But dude, the choices, I was like,
everything.
it's almost like an Ace Ventura level of
It's like
like.
if it's like if it's like if Jim was taking Ace Ventura seriously. It's borderline caricature.
Oh
And
yeah.
mind you, and that's just Alec Baldwin. Fred Ward is going straight caricature. He's going straight lunatic style. And then you also have Jennifer Jason Leigh being a caricature of like this innocent, the innocent prostitute version, you know what I mean? Like,
Southern.
whole thing, Southern thing. I'm st naive, it's just like a whole thing. Everybody is at full fucking tilt in that movie.
Oh yeah.
And then they're also like, oh yeah, and we're in like a, essentially like a Jim Thompson, book or, you know what I mean? Like, just this ridiculous, which, who did it? Is it Elmer Leonard? No, it's
No, it's
not.
George Armitage who directed
George
one of my
Jones.
other favorite. Oh, who wrote it? It's
Yeah,
what's on Jim
it's a
Thompson
crime
Armitage?
writer who wrote it.
Charles Wilford.
And it's funny, and it's just also funny because it's like Miami, which is just like disgusting and hot and like fucking
And
ridiculous.
loud and bright.
Yeah, just insane.
The wardrobe is fantastic in this movie.
Oh no, Baldwin's looking, dude, when he breaks up the like robbery
Yeah.
in the grocery, the
Oh
like
yeah.
weird like 7-Eleven, the outfits are just, yeah, he's insane.
I love this movie a lot. This was
Excuse me.
fighting for a spot in the top five.
You had it in your top five for a long
Yeah,
time,
there's a
and
few
it was,
my top five is really interchangeable, and there's a few that could easily come and go, but
same, same. We got a couple of sequels. I'm just gonna go over them quick. They're both very good, or they're both fun. They're not as good as the originals, but they're both fun. We got RoboCop 2. We got Die Hard 2.
Die Hard 2 I love because it's the dumbest Die Hard. And I'm just talking about the three. Like, the first one's perfect. The third one's kind of perfect.
Yeah.
The second one is so dumb. They just take the exact same premise from the first one, and they just go way more gory.
If it ain't way more if it ain't broke, just make it
gorier.
So then next, we have another film that I did not realize was so close to both Jake and I's hearts. I really did not. Even though when we think about our lives and our friendship and the way we've always interacted with each other, it makes all the sense in the world. And that would be Problem Child.
Totally makes sense. It's a wonderful movie directed by Dennis Dugan, who later went on to direct almost every single
Adam Sandler movies.
Like 90% of them.
So, Problem Child.
It's a pretty dark movie, too.
No, Problem Child's way fucking dark. I've seen it a few times in the past couple of years because it's been on TV, and I've always been like, oh, like, that's one of those, like, kind of nostalgia ones. And I'm like, oh, fuck, like, I'll give it sure, I'd love to watch it again.
Yeah.
That kid is an actual, it's not even Problem Child, he's just Devil Child.
He's fucking evil.
And also, that kid, incredible.
He's great. One of the greatest child performances.
One of the finest child performances. But also, and this is never to be underestimated, the genius that is John Ritter.
Oh.
That was John Ritter. What am I, to me, I swear to God, man, like, I think if John Ritter would have lived a little longer, man, like, I think he would have, like, got an Oscar.
Him and
genuinely
Sling Blade?
Incredible. Dude,
how good was he in that?
Very funny humanness to everything that he ever did, and especially a fucking Problem Child, where he's just dealing with this shitbag of a kid that he has and is just trying to make the best of it, but also like trying to get laid and dealing with this new chick. And I don't know, man, the kid putting the fucking bugs in the like meal, and also the granddad.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Jack Warden. Amazing.
Jack Warden. Yeah, and Jack Warden.
Let's not forget Amy Yazbek, who was a huge crush for me. And wonderful
actress. She was the new wife, right? The new wife.
Yeah, and she was married to John Ritter until he died.
Was she?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck me. Yeah.
They
incredible.
Met at a reading at Dennis Dugan's house for Problem Child. I have always loved her. She was so, so funny in Robin Hood Men in Tights. And in Dracula Dead and Loving It. She was also in The Mask. Oh, she's just great.
Dude.
I love her.
Like,
hilarious
incredible work.
Comedy.
With her weird, like, Southern Belle shtick.
Yeah, I think like, she's great.
No, man. Problem Child's a big one for us, I think. Yeah. Which I didn't realize it was so big for you, too. But so
and Problem Child, too. But we'll get there.
Oh, no. But that's, of course. Next up, we have one that is we do not feel the same about at all as we feel about Problem Child. And that would be fucking Wilt Stillman's Metropolitan.
No, thanks.
and we're only mentioning this because so many people do love it and they do love that guy. Man, fuck this movie. I watched that shit again the other day. I'd seen it when I was younger and I didn't like it. Watched it again a couple weeks ago, and man, fuck that movie. It's funny because I saw a writer that I read. He brought up a prompt that somebody had brought up on Twitter, and they said, who is a director that you were full in on at the beginning, and now you're just like, you've given up on? And they've kind of, maybe not betrayed you, but like, you know, you just have given up on you. I don't fuck with it anymore. And I saw a lot of people refer to Wilt Stillman. And it was funny because a lot of the same people who were saying that were going, I was into it at first. And then I've watched them again recently. And they just come off as privileged and like bullshit and bad.
I like The Last Days of Disco. He's got a few that I like.
Yeah, but Metropolitan's not one of them. On the opposite side of that spectrum, one that I love, one that you love, David Lynch, Wild at Heart.
This is one of those that could have been on the top five. One of the most entertaining, sexy, cool movies, chock full of bad omens and bad bitches. Willem Dafoe being more evil than anyone ever has been.
Come on, man. Bobby Peru for us is basically a noun.
Oh, I mean, the whole movie is just a who's who of fucking creeps and weirdos.
Isabella Rossellini, Diane Ladd,
Crispin Glover,
Willem Dafoe,
John Lurie.
Yeah. It's marvelous. It's just marvelous. But also, fuck it. We'd fuck it. Fuck it up the ass. It's not one of those ones we're gonna ever talk about too much and like ruin it. Like,
Yeah, if
just,
you haven't seen it, then do
dude, just
yourself a
shut up and
favor.
watch. Yeah, shut up and watch Wild at Heart. Go away. Like,
It's also, I would
have
say,
you,
maybe his most
like,
digestible movie.
then we got Men at Work, which is an Emilio Estevez jam. Did you watch that? I wanted
It's
to.
his
I
first film
know.
that he directed.
Yes. And it's him and Charlie.
Yeah.
Yeah,
It's kind of a mess, but
yeah.
it's kind of cool. It's kind of a punk movie.
Next up, we have one that also was about to be in your top five, and I have seen a few times. And it was kind of one of my early, it was actually, I think, my earliest introduction to her. And it was, it's Jane Campion with An Angel at My Table, which is just a remarkably beautiful movie that is, it's one of those ones that if you, I feel like if you saw this at a certain, if you saw this early, you know, it kind of sets you up to be able to watch things like this later on in life.
Yeah, I think it's one of the greatest depictions of mental disorder or emotional sort of distress,
Sure.
and it just plummets you in the face just for two plus hours with just this person's life, and you get to know almost
From
a precursor
I mean from
to
child to adult. I mean, for there's three different actresses
yeah, it's
playing
like
her.
Moonlight in that
Really,
way, kind of.
yeah.
Where yeah, you really but you get it's not just like a biopic kind of movie. It's like you get three very specific periods of this person's life.
So, but so yeah, so it's just
With
it
the
kind of gives
author Janet Frame.
yeah, a little bit more of a literary backing to this instead of biopic,
Yeah.
more than a biopic.
She was on a tear, Jane Campion, because she just before this she did Sweetie, and then
She did
after
Sweetie,
this, the
yeah, that we
piano.
love. Yeah, Piano was 93, like, killing it, killing it. Next up, we have one that also kind of close to our hearts in its own very specific way. Dennis Hopper, The Hotspot.
Oh yeah.
You have a VHS copy of that. I've seen it 300 times.
Yeah.
We have the probably one of the most incomparably beautiful trios of people on the face of the earth. When it's like peak Virginia Madsen, peak Jennifer Connelly, and then just Don Johnson just being fucking delicious, and appealing to them both. It's a very pulpy thing.
Yeah, you can really feel the dust.
You get the dust from Texas. You get the like sleaziness. It's really sexy. We're not gonna go crazy and like, dive deep, but it's a good time. Next up, we got Graffiti Bridge by Prince.
Which I watched.
Did you
I did. I
talk to
rented it
me?
for $1.99 on Amazon
I
Prime.
yeah, I saw that it was that cheap. It's
It's
not a
not
great
great.
movie. It's not a great movie. It's not a great movie. We're not,
I'm not sure. I mean, it's basically about the rivalry between the kid and
him
Morris Day,
and Morris Day, yeah.
and which I
As
thought
if
was
they
pretty
hadn't
well covered.
just explored that before.
I was like, this is a little redundant.
You think, yeah,
Obviously,
yeah.
there's jams, but
Dude,
again,
jams galore.
not the jams that were in Purple Rain, though. So
Yeah.
I found myself sort of clock watching a bit while I
Yeah,
was,
of course.
and I'm
It's
always
fine.
happy to just watch Prince and just see
Do
it.
anything.
Morris Day is maybe like
Exactly.
no, nothing against him, he's fantastic, but like I don't know if he needed to have such a big role.
We didn't know if he needed a second spotlight.
Yeah.
The Purple Rain might have been enough. Next up, we got Child's Play 2, another one in the Chucky series. Big fan,
One of my
love
favorite
Chucky.
kills,
Of which of
that
what
series, the plastic where Chucky's in the back seat and he puts the plastic over the driver's. Whenever I get into like the driver's seat at night, I always have to look back just to make sure there's not a
Always
creepy
just checking
doll.
for it. All right, so then we got one that I watched again recently. I saw it when I was pretty young. I liked it then, but then I watched it again recently and I was not a fan. And that was a director who I'm a big fan of, Stephen Frears, The Grifters. And we have John Cusack, Annette Bening, and Angelica Houston. A fan of all three of them. Not a big fan of this movie, man. And I'm interested because I know you watched it with Charlotte,
Yeah, I've
and
seen
I
it a
know
few times.
she wasn't a
It's got its issues. I thought that, spoiler alert, but I thought that it was going to be more akin to like House of Games, where the whole thing is sort of a grift. And so the ending is sort of a bit of a letdown when it's like, oh, that's all it is. Like, you just literally want to fuck your mom. But I like how pulpy it is on purpose, just the way it's shot. And like, I think you said how ugly it is, and it is, but it's very much.
It's an ugly movie, and I don't mean like in terms of cinematography. I mean in terms of like morally, which
Yeah, and it's drab and it's.
I have a very, I think we both kind of have a very relationship with morals and morality in films. And I don't have a problem with people being pieces of shit, whatever, like my ilk, it's my people, it's what I'm used to, whatever. But this is what my problem was with the grifters. I thought there was a huge issue with miscasting. I thought Annette Bening was miscast, and I thought Angelica Houston was horribly miscast.
I didn't think so.
I think both. I think Annette Bening was Annette Bening did I don't think Annette Bening pulled off the charisma of being able to pull this guy in. And again, he eventually, like, kind of sees through it and, tells her to fuck off. But then the whole thing with, like, Angelica Houston and John Cusack and, like, him being her mom, but then she's like, oh, well, what if I'm not your mom? And, like, him wanting to fuck Angelica Houston, like, it didn't work to me. It
Yeah.
absolutely 100% did not fucking work for me. And this whole thing where it's just like came in later and she goes, after she's fucked herself out of every opportunity, and she just like basically just wants to take his money. And he's like,
Yeah.
no, you can't just take my money. You know what I
She's
mean? Like,
they're
and she's
all
like,
grifters. They're all pieces of
they're
shit,
all
though.
grifters, but there's like a certain code that I think that has been established in other films, and
Well,
just
tell it to
like
Jim Thompson.
it didn't work. I just didn't think it worked, man. Like, I just didn't
Annette Bening
I
made
just
sense
didn't
to
think it
me.
worked.
She's like a
To me, it didn't
spinning
work.
psychotic top that, you get wrapped up in that
And I
hurricane and
get
it's hard
that,
to
but
get
like,
out of it.
but Angelica Houston, and especially the thing with her and like John Cusack, like it was so sitting here as a person, I was not a fan of that one.
My
I think
favorite
put it
scene in the
lightly.
movie is with between Angelica Houston and Pat Hingle, who played Bobo,
Guy, the
the
gangster who
boss.
like
He
burned her
was
hand.
fucking terrifying, I thought.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was. He
So
was
menacing.
nuts. Yeah, he
And
was
the way
crazy.
that he plays it, I think, just like the balancing act of that scene and like how he like kind of will
Yeah.
charm or let her.
It's a flashback.
Oh, it's so good.
He was pretty great in that. I'm gonna mention a couple more before we get into our top five. We're gonna talk about a few movies that, again, we watched. One of them is Cold Dog Soup,
I watched this
which
last night.
you watched it last night. This was one of the many films produced by George Harrison, and we haven't really talked about this, but there's a bunch of films produced by George Harrison that we've ended up talking about, and some that we haven't, and some that have featured quite prominently. And this was the last of those. It was the last one. Yeah, it was this and like a Monty Python one in the same year, Nuns on the Run,
Oh, right,
1990 as
with
well.
Eric
Yeah,
Idle.
with Eric Idle, exactly.
George Harrison started this company because he wanted to see Life of Brian,
Yeah.
which the studios were dropping. And he was such a huge Monty Python fan, which I think is pretty evident with, when you look at the Beatles and their antics, that
Exactly. Why wouldn't he be? Exactly.
that he was like, I think he was quoted as saying it was the most expensive movie ticket of all time or something. So he basically started this company, Handmade Films, so that he and got
Which
some American financiers.
Handmade Films, which started, if we're going to start before we've started this podcast, before where our starting point of this podcast was. 1979, obviously Monty Python's Life of Brian. Then we got ones that we had talked about, or one that we had talked about, Mona Lisa from 1986 with Bob Hoskins. Then we have Shanghai Surprise with Sean Penn and Madonna, which is basically the reason they maybe got together and or divorced. Then we have three, four, no, five in a row that we talked about very highly of, some maybe not. But we have, dude, he produced With Dale and I, which is our number one movie in 1987. He produced Five Corners, which we talked about fondly. Tim Robbins, Jodie Foster, John Turturro, How to Get Ahead in Advertising, which I know was in your
One
top
of my
five
favorites.
in 89. Checking Out, which was also one of your favorites. And then we have Cold Dog Soup, which I watched and I recommended to you, and you just texted to me. All the only text I received was just, how did this movie get made? Featuring a great performance by Mr. Randy Quaid.
This is like a movie that's right up my alley, and yet I was fucking exhausted by it.
And mind you, it's like not long.
It's so annoying. You told me that it's the better version of checking out, whereas for me, checking out the comedy hits, like the jokes line up, the performances are taken seriously enough that I can become invested.
Oh no, this whole thing was like absurd.
But it's absurd, and I like that. But and I was really into it for like the first 20 minutes. I was like, oh, I'm really enjoying this. I actually texted my manager who represents Frank Whaley, and I was like, oh nice. I'm watching your client right now in the crazy movie Cold Dog Soup.
Yeah,
which I don't even know if she's heard of.
Of course,
and everybody goes for it. In particular, I really liked the actress.
Marvelous.
I love her. What's her name?
We should great. Oh no, we should. I'm sorry. Oh wait, I didn't put her in my name.
She was my favorite part of the movie.
No, she was great.
And that's what I also liked that so much about checking out was I felt like the female protagonist, if you will.
Christine Harnos.
Christine Harnos,
absolutely.
She was given
spectacular.
A lot to do for like the role that she had. I love the hand thing, the whole thing in the pool at the gym at the beginning where she's softening.
She was great. Yeah, she was great.
Just her whole devious sexual sort of like willing to switch, like willing to just when she wants to bounce with Randy Quaid, she's just like, let's just fucking.
But she's not trying to. Again, she was still down with Whaley. She was trying to get what she needed to get out of Whaley. She was
great. What the fuck did she need? She wanted to sell a dog, dude.
I loved her.
She loved to live in the moment. She was so good. And I think
she's not spontaneity. She was just like a wild chick. She was
great. I mean, the takeaway from that movie, fantastic. I guess, is about living in the moment. Being loyal.
Yeah.
I guess. Like also, being a man of your word.
Kind of.
A person of your word. Really. That's what it comes down to. But it's so insane. Like,
to me, that's more your kind of movie than checking out.
Yeah, it makes sense. In it's in line
to me.
With
it rates head. as like a youth. And again, but also I was like, again, watched it and like loved it. Even like, dude, who's it? Ben Gazzara shows up.
Ben Gazzara.
Is it Ben Gazzara or like Harry Dean Stanton? Seymour Cassell. Seymour Cassell shows up. That was so.
That was really good.
Again, dude, that movie, kind of rules.
What anybody really
and the twins doing. And like the box office.
Yeah, that was great. No, that whole sequence.
That movie. Fantastic. I'm sorry, man. That movie kind of rules. the sequence at the end with them like burying the dog and then him like talking to the next guy. Like, come on.
No, it's kind of great, but it's also so annoying.
The whole sequence with them with like the voodoo, like
yeah, that was great too. It's a really.
I'm sorry, dude. You're like talking to yourself. That movie kind of rules.
No, it's good.
It's kind of great. I was like, this is a Jake. And again, I was watching it and I was like, I'm having a fucking blast. I was just annoyed that you weren't like sitting on the couch next to me.
Yeah.
Because I was like, damn, we should be like 4 or 5 beers deep, and just like having a blast with this one.
I think that it would be more fun with a buddy. That's for sure.
Yeah. Again, I fully agree. Why do you think I was so like immediately like, dude, you need to watch this one.
Yeah,
it's great.
Well, I watched it and
it was great. I'm glad you did.
I'll the opposite see it again in my life. But.
It's great. It's great. On the opposite spectrum. Mm-hmm. On the opposite spectrum, we're going to talk about a movie that is just outside of both of our top fives. And it comes from the master, Aki Kaurismäki. Oh. And that film would be The Match Factory Girl, which we have discussed and is one of our favorite kind of films. Mm. Which is somebody gets shit on for an hour to 2 hours, maybe even longer. Honestly, kind of the longer the better. And then they just fuck everybody up. I think that's like one of our favorite genres. And there are movies that we're not going to talk about now that we're going to talk about later on in way wilder regard. The Match Factory Girl is absolutely one of those films. I totally see where Kaurismäki was coming from. This was a masterful film.
It's
Yeah, completely masterful. And
Masterful.
it should be more seen for sure, because it's gorgeous. The central performance is really fantastic.
Oh, she's just incredible in this. Incredible.
You feel for
incredible.
her so hard.
Just basically like an out, and also, this is a double. This is a double. It is a double of our favorite things, which is somebody getting shit on for the entirety of a film, and then them getting revenge. But also, it intersects with our other favorite kind of movie, the kind of movie that's an hour long.
True.
Because this movie, I believe, is like an hour and like 12 minutes or something.
Yeah.
It's very short. And it is
Yes.
just great.
Her name is Katie Otinen, I believe. And she's been in a lot of his
Otinen,
movies.
yeah.
She's
Otinen, yeah.
still working with him. She was in Le Havre in 2011, which is a
Great.
great movie. Yeah,
Great.
she's
Yeah, this
wonderful.
movie's an hour and 9 minutes long.
Yeah, perfect.
Which, if you've listened to any of this podcast, sweet spot.
Yeah, that's like the
It's
perfect
perfect. It's
runtime.
a perfect move. So, much not. What am I saying? Sticking to the title of the film, this is a girl who works in a match factory, who is basically getting shit on by
Can
her
you imagine anything
mom.
more banal?
Yeah, more being her getting shit on by her mom, who's now married to a new guy, so it's her stepdad. They live together. They basically take her money every week. They don't like let her enjoy her paycheck. Her
She
only
buys a
ally,
dress, and it's
yeah, she buys a
heartbreaking
dress,
to
and they
her.
like shit on her because they're just like, "Why? Just give us that money." Her only real ally is her brother, who has moved away from home and like care actually cares for her. It's actually a cool relationship, and he is just also marvelous looking,
Yeah.
just the sickest mullet. He has a pool table in his apartment. Like, what the fuck? He's sick.
Yeah.
He's a chef, or a cook, a chef, whatever. She goes out to a nightclub, meets kind of intriguing older man. He seduces her. She ends up getting pregnant. He denies her.
Tells her to
And then
get rid of
she
the kid.
tells her to get rid of the kid. And then she proceeds to just kill everybody who's wronged her. I don't give a fuck. I'm spoiling that
It's
movie.
so satisfying.
It's incredibly satisfying. It's the best movie. She gets shit on for an hour, and then in the last, or she gets shit on for 45 minutes. In the last like 20, she just kills everybody. And honestly, fuck yeah, girl.
And it's
Girl
really
power.
funny too, though. Like I was laughing throughout, especially
No,
that whole
there was
opening.
some like funny shit. It was like pretty fucking funny. Like it
Yeah.
was great. Yeah, the match. You can cut out the description, but anyway, the Match Factory Girl is one of our favorite kinds of movies, and honestly, just like a spectacular movie. Jacob, it is time for our top fives.
You didn't want to mention King
Oh,
or Alice?
oh shit, Kings. Oh shit, sorry, because I had cut out so much other shit.
I
Oh my
figured
god,
you'd want to
yeah.
mention those too.
My bad, my bad, my bad. It's because I had cut out. I literally was like scratching off a
Yeah,
bunch
yeah.
of other shit that I was like, we don't like have the capacity to talk about. All right, so two more before we get to the to our top fives, and they are literally, I think, essentially co like number sixes, and that would be Mr. Abel Ferrara with King of New York and Mr. Woody Allen with Alice. I, excuse me, have watched these two recently. Alice specifically for this because I wanted to get a better grasp on it, and King of New York just a few times because it's been on TV and I just like keep watching it. King of New York I remember seeing in high school. I was around 15 or so. And Alice, I think around the same time. Alice was a big one because they used to show it on, it was WPIX here, Channel 11. They used to show it late night. And it held me pretty, I was very much captivated by it because it was just like a haunting and beautiful romantic film. And I had that idea in my head But I thought, okay, with time, maybe I was like, over romanticizing it. Watched it again recently, and Alice is such a romantic and beautiful film. It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. An incredible performance from Mia Farrow. Great performance from the god William Hurt, and one of my favorite small but like remarkable performances from Alec Baldwin
Alec was really just
as a ghost.
home running.
He was just, I mean, in all the years that we've done, he's just been fucking killing it. I think I have a note here from it, and I think I have, yeah, Alec Baldwin as best actor, because Alec Baldwin was in Alice, Miami Blues, and fucking Hunt for Red October. So I think we're giving him MVP for the year. But Alice, you can speak to it, man. I was watching it and I was sending you pictures from me watching it, and it was just like,
You're saying this is what a movie should look like.
this is what movies should look like.
Yeah, that's
And
gorgeous.
this is what movies should be like, and this is what movies should make you feel like. And it's such a crazy thing because it's just like this fantastical film about a woman who is interacting with the basically she's in an unhappy marriage, and she's interacting with the true love of her life who died when they were young. And it's just, man, it just makes you feel
And dealing with the
so many
guilt and
fucking,
temptation of a new lover as well.
yeah, and the guilt and temptation of a new lover. And nah, man, like, it just, like, I to me, I wrote it to you. I'm pretty sure that's what I said. Just like, they just don't make them like this anymore, and it makes you feel like how a movie should make you feel—fantastical and lovely and like a bit whimsical and optimistic and a little melancholy. It's just everything that
Yeah, it's
movies sh
beautiful.
should be. Everything the movie should be. King of New York, on the other hand, is, I don't know, you tell me.
I mean, talk about ugly. Like, these are some bad motherfuckers. I think it's one of the greatest Christopher Walken roles.
Should I do it now or
Go for it. Yeah.
well, Christopher Walken, the king of incredible line readings of all time. He gives probably the greatest line reading of his entire career. Lawrence Fishburne, Steve Buscemi, Giancarlo Esposito. Not even Giancarlo Esposito. They all come up to him,
Lawrence
whatever they.
Fishburne.
No, I said Lawrence Fishburne. They all come up to him, and they're like kind of doing this like tug of war of like, oh, well, are they foes or friends? And they go, Frank. Lawrence Fishburne goes, Frank, you know what we got for you? And he brings him. He opens up a briefcase full of money. And Christopher Walken does the greatest line reading in the face of movie history. He goes, well, I love money. And it's just about, and then he goes into a dance and they all like hug him and love him because he's just been in jail. King of New York is the fucking best. So we got Christopher Walken, Lawrence Fishburne, we got Giancarlo Esposito, we got Paul Calderon, Steve Buscemi, Teresa Randall, who's incredible, Roger Guinevere Smith, who's just never been bad in anything in the world. He's just always been just, I don't know, the best actor ever. And then for cops, we have Wesley Snipes as a cop, which is crazy because we're just, it can go in a lot of ways with Wesley Snipes. But then I will say, we have the worst actor of all time in this movie. As great as Christopher Walken is, as great as Giancarlo Esposito is, Paul Calderon, fucking Lawrence Fishburne, obviously Steve Buscemi. We have, and he's gonna come up a bunch of more times because it is the 90s now. We're into the 90s. And we're gonna have to address it because every movie that we mention him in, it's because, in spite of him, not because of him. We have the worst actor of all time, and that is David Caruso. The equivalent of a piece of wet white bread. Like, David Caruso has never been good. He's never been convincing. He's never been sexy. He's never been intimidating.
What is it about him, then? Because people do.
I don't know. Because he was in NYPD Blue, and I guess he was good in that for like the first season or two, and then he got too big for his britches and thought he could be a movie star. But in reality, David Crusoe, you fucking suck, and you've never been good in anything. And the thing is that he's Italian, but he looks like the most Irish person of all time. And he wants to always, if you look at his movies, he's always Italian. And it's like, dude, we've never believed you in that ever. Mm-hmm. Just play a Mick.
He could even be like Jewish.
No, he couldn't. Because even Keitel can't even do Jewish, and he's Jewish. Jade?
Oh, man.
We're supposed to expect you're hot and sexy?
This is terrible.
And he's supposed to catch fucking King of New York. He's a better cop than Wesley Snipes. Argue with your mother. Don't argue with me. Like, fuck off. Not your mother. I love Michelle.
Oh, we'll save some ammunition.
But this was the beginning of his bullshit.
Okay.
Anyway. So
top fives?
Yeah, I'm ready for top five.
All right, I'll start us off.
Top five war factors. Worst actor, David Caruso. All right, sorry.
Number five, I'll start us off with The Exorcist Please. 3, which is written and directed by William Peter Blatty, who was the author of the original Exorcist novel, as well as Legion, which this movie is based on. It stars George C. Scott, Ed Flanders, Jason Miller, making a reprise appearance, Scott Wilson, and one of my favorite actors of all time, top five favorite actors, Brad Dourif.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Brad Dourif. I know that this is not a movie that is probably up your alley. It's not one that you wanted to watch, but I would encourage you to at least go on YouTube and watch the Brad Dourif interrogation scenes, because he's doing some crazy shit in this movie. This is coming off of the heels of The Exorcist II, The Heretic, which I actually find to be a pretty interesting movie. It's not a horror. It's very much like a almost hospital procedural, whereas The Exorcist III is sort of less horror than more psychological thriller, I guess. George C. Scott is turning in some really, really interesting choices. It brings in a lot of the Catholic guilt elements, obviously. I think that what is so interesting about The Exorcist series is that it works so well for so many people who are not of this religious ilk. I mean, did you find the original scary?
Yeah, I loved you. I loved
you. You grew up Catholic.
Not really, but like, I mean, I stopped believing in that shit very early. But I saw, by the time I had seen The Exorcist, the first one, I was, way out of that. I mean, like, I just, I was still in Catholic school, but I knew it was all nonsense. More than anything, my mom. Because my mom was just, she had seen it in theaters. And she'd always just told me, you're into movies, you got to watch The Exorcist. It fucking scared the shit out of her.
Yeah.
And your so mom? When I finally, my mom to this day is still scared of The Exorcist.
So is my mom.
Yeah. And then I watched it and I was like, man, that was so good.
It's so scary.
It was just genuinely fucking good and scary and, I think the thing that makes it scary, and I would say even to be maybe a little bit more specific, like bone chilling or creepy, is because of maybe some of the stuff that I had, gone to school and they taught to you and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. The oppressive imagery.
It made it a little more plausible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's still not plausible. Obviously, I knew it wasn't going to ever happen, but like, it makes it plausible enough to where if it sneaks in a little bit, it's fucking scary. And that is definitely the prime example of that.
Well, my mom, who's definitely very Catholic, saw this movie when it came out in theaters. She was pregnant with her first child. And my dad was out, like, kind of hitting the pavement, kind of doing the, like, door-to-door salesman thing and not around. And she went alone to the cinema, watched this movie, and she said that she literally didn't sleep for a year.
I think my mom told me something similar, where I think she said she went like by herself, and same kind of thing where she was just like, shouldn't have done that. Because she's not the type either. So it's just like, she wasn't pregnant, but like, but then you're pregnant. Like, that's not, it's like being pregnant and going to see Rosemary's Baby. Like, what the fuck are you doing?
But yeah, anyways, back on The Exorcist 3, it's very mm-hmm. much about sort of in a Silence of the Lambs sort of way. It's like trying to find another killer. It starts off with a young black kid getting murdered and essentially crucified, put on a mm-hmm. cross. And then it just gets more violent and upsetting from there.
It's
just the idea of possession. And it's a very creepy movie, which I know has kind of garnered more of a cult following in years. And I think that people have kind of come around to it.
I think people have learned to appreciate the nuances that have come with the horror sequels. People have come to realize that they're a little more nuanced. They weren't necessarily cash grabs like how the new ones are.
No, you know? And maybe they didn't have the same, like...
I mean, they were, but, like, they had more interesting things going on, too.
A lot of them did, yeah. And they were, you know, they were banking on some pretty interesting directors. I think it's an inspired choice to have the novelist direct this third one.
That's insane. That's just crazy that they even did that. Super interesting choice.
Yeah. And it's very much based on aspects of the Zodiac killer, who also, by the way, really liked the original Exorcist film. So.
So
when you say that, you know, movies and music don't inspire, I don't know if that's accurate.
My number five, I'm going to go with a film that it's funny to me that I saw it many years ago. And when I saw things from this year, I immediately jumped to it. And when I watched it again, when I rewatched it, I remembered why I immediately jumped to it. And it is Pump Up the Volume. Mm. Which was, oh God, I'm looking at my, Jesus, am I a fool? Pump Up the Volume, directed by Alan Moyle, who ended up directing Empire Records, and his previous film was Times Square from 1980.
Oh, I love Times Square.
I know you do. Pump Up the Volume is very much in the vein of my previous number one, Talk Radio. Which I know you're a big fan of when you finally got to watch it. I think Pump Up the Volume is just kind of a great precursor to the 90s and also kind of like a death knell to the 80s in which, you know, just like one switching over from one generation to the next. It's the story of this kid who moves from the East, he moves from New York to Arizona, or wherever the fuck he's, you know, wherever the fuck he's at. Phoenix. In Arizona. And he is a very, like, shy, withdrawn kid because he doesn't have any friends. And he ends up just creating this larger-than-life radio persona that becomes, you know, kind of like the shock jock or whatever of his day. And it kind of goes anywhere from him doing like masturbation jokes and kind of potty humor to really serious, like taking kids' calls and just filling out with the kids of his, you know, I think it's within a certain mile radius are feeling like. And he has kids like calling in saying, hey man, like, I feel like I want to kill myself. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what's going on, or I'm really horny, or, you know, what's that?
Doesn't someone do it?
Somebody does, yeah. One of the kids does. And they see him as a threat instead of what he is, which is the voice of the youth. And, you know, it's a really interesting one. He plays all kinds of cool music. His theme music is like fucking Leonard Cohen, and everybody knows. And he goes,
cool music. I'm looking at the
soundtrack. It's really great. No, the soundtracks, I've been telling you, man. Like
Henry Rollins.
Yeah, Bad Brains, Pixies. Dude, he plays fucking Wave of Mutilation plays in like one of my, and it just made me realize again how like incredible that song is. He like raps along to the Beastie Boys, and you're thinking about it, it's like, it's kind of corny, but then you're like, yeah, you're from the East Coast. Like I get it. He's like, it's great. It's a great film, and it's very much in the vein of Talk Radio, but a little bit, but again, enough years later, and with a certainly compelling enough lead in Christian Slater that you buy it and you get where this kid's coming from, and you get where the change in terms of the culture is coming from. I think it's a really good movie. It's really well made, really well written. He plays the shit out of it. Everybody's really good in it. It's kind of a banger of a movie. It's not number one like Talk Radio was for the year that came out, But in the same vein, and you know, just I think just as, you know, as interesting in a different way. Changing of the guard, if you will. And also hard to fucking find. Like, you can't fucking find it. You have to like illegally stream it, like fucking to find it, which is not a mark to it. It sucks that you can't just like fucking find it. But yeah, I hope you know, if it was if we had a, you know, if there was any justice, it'd be a thing that like Criterion or like, you know, one of these other kind of things puts out and just like, you know, gets the rights to and more
Perhaps
people are
that's
able to see it.
forthcoming.
Certainly worthy.
Somebody put Pump Up the Volume out.
Please, please, somebody put Pump Up the Volume out. I had
So.
to stream it. The last time I had seen it, they were showing it on HBO quite a bit, and it was able to like, you know, be able to watch it. But like, yeah, it's a, you know, it's one of those ones.
All right, so four, I'm going to go with Close Up. This is a film by Abbas Kiarostami, who's just a wonderful director who will come up time and time again on this podcast. And it's a very interesting, I would say that this is a movie that's just essential viewing for anyone. It's just one of those movies that one must experience in a lifetime because it's so unique and
You know my opposition to any film that anybody says that about. I felt that for a long time about this. And you were very adamant. You said, no, you gotta watch this, you gotta watch this. And I said, fuck, you know what? It's given it, at this point, it's my chance to watch this. And I will back you up wholeheartedly. I'm very like oppositional to like, oh, this is one of the ones you must watch before you know. This was absolutely 100% worth the hype. I was dreading it a little bit. You remember, I told you.
Yeah, it felt like homework, right?
It felt like homework. Then I started watching it. It fucked me up. It blew my whole like understanding of that up.
He redefines what it is to make a movie in this, and
Which
within
is
it as well.
which was part of the like hesitance for me because I was like, oh God, half documentary, half fiction, whatever. And then you watch and you go, it doesn't fucking matter.
The cooperation that he managed to between all the parties involved with this, essentially what a crime
I mean,
that,
it's essentially a reenactment of a crime.
yeah, but performed by the people who were involved in the crime.
Yeah, to this day, I think like I don't know, unheard of. Like, what the fuck? I guess maybe like that Oppenheim movie or whatever. But like, what the fuck?
And it's just a beautiful example of what humanity and forgiveness can be, and how people can kind of come together, even if the details are a little foggy, how they can come together and sort of understand one another and accept one another, and for the sake of art, or can they can learn to.
I think that's the like underlying, it's not even underlying, it's like completely out there for the sake of art. This man does this crime because he's essentially like us.
This in a.
He's us without like the infrastructure, watching TCM, you know, being able to buy Criterions.
Right.
Like this guy's like every single time they ask him why he did what he did, it's because he loves art. And you once you realize some of the history of, you know, Iranian culture and, you know, some of the like limitations put upon them. That's what he felt he could do.
And it's sort of justified.
It
Yeah, it's.
kind of is, you know?
But just to break it down really quick, it's basically about a guy named Hussein who's a cinephile, and he's obsessed with this director Makhlbaf.
Makhlbaf, yeah.
He meets this woman on a bus. He convinces her that he is this director, and then he goes home with her and convinces the entire her entire family that he's a director and that, you know, he maybe
But
want to
that's the
work
thing
with
too.
them.
But that's the thing too. Her kids are
Interested in film,
cinephiles.
yeah.
Yeah, they're interested in film. So it's this thing that it's like it's a suspension of belief on both parts. This suspension, his thing is that like, listen, I'm gonna be this director, and they suspend the belief because they want so much to be involved. And it's just like this kind of desperation that like could only come from that culture and the lack of
Resources.
sort of access and resources to art and or cinema or whatever. Like it's wholly individual.
And you never feel he's being devious.
No,
His aim
it's
is totally true.
very, his aim is totally true.
It's such a beautiful example of like what we're capable of as human beings.
Then there's like a lot of imposter theory going on. And a lot of it is true because it is not as humanistic as this guy is.
Yeah.
You know, this guy, sure.
What do you got for four?
Talk about gorgeous film. For number four, I have a childhood classic. I know that you are a big fan of. I am a big fan of. This is another one in the pantheon of I made my dad take me to see it 600 times.
You've mentioned this movie to me throughout our friendship. Like top five, the movies easily. You've mentioned more than any easily. Other movie.
And just watching it again, it's a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. It's the only good movie this guy's ever made. So it is Warren Beatty's Dick Tracy. And by best movie he's ever made, I mean directorially. As a director, it's the only movie I give a shit that he's really? Ever directed. I think I have a fuck about Reds.
Both are good.
I'll watch it when we get to that year. I think the lore of Warren Beatty is more interesting than Warren Beatty. As an actor, as a director, as a producer, I think he has a huge ego and a huge amount of hubris that is just not, his talent doesn't match up to it. Except for Dick Tracy.
I like him a lot.
Dick Tracy is a masterpiece, I'll say that. It's the only thing that also captures the spirit of an actual comic book or a comic strip. Because I used to read Dick Tracy, they still had the comic strip in like the New York Post and like all the New York newspapers when I was a kid. Donna is fantastic. Forsyth. Dustin Hoffman, goddamn Mandy Patinkin.
People have talked about Beatty on this movie. Danny Elfman said he was nuts.
Yeah, I'm sure. I read the Beatty, one of the Beatty biographies, I guess like the main one, Star. There wasn't like that much about this, which I was like bummed about because I've read so much about his life, and we're getting towards like the end, and I'm like, oh, into some Dick Tracy shit, sick. And it just wasn't, you know, but also Dick, so also. Warren Beatty was expecting this to be like a franchise and expecting it to be like way bigger than it was. Did you ever hear the thing about like how there was like, you know, like a certain amount of million like yellow fedoras like delivered to Toys R Us and they like did not sell out? Like all this shit. Like it was like kind of a flop, but yeah. But anyway, all right. So I'm done talking about Dick Tracy. You're number
three.
Yes.
Number three, I'm going to go with the Rob Reiner directed film Misery, based on the Stephen King novel of the same name. Starring James Caan and Kathy Bates, and in a small role, Lauren Bacall.
Academy Award winner for this film, Best Actress, Kathy Bates.
Yeah, I don't know if it gets any better. Like, I just really think so nuanced.
I mean, that's like top notch.
One of the most terrifying performances of all time. One of the most, I think, terrifying movies of all time, just in terms of like the idea of being completely at the will of an obsessive psychotic person's mood shifts and swings.
Yeah.
And I've seen it many times, but it was the last movie I saw in theaters before at the Egyptian
in LA.
It was part of a series that the director of The Invisible Man had programmed that were movies that inspired him. Just a perfect movie, I think.
Because you know, I'm not a big King guy at all. I actually great
stuff like, when it's based in reality.
Misery, and that's what Misery is. Doesn't hit you with any fucking voodoo, you know,
supernatural
bullshit, and it's genuinely horrifying. Yeah, it's great work on both their parts. Because you know we're both incredible. Huge James Caan fans, and then and Kathy Bates just unmatched.
Reiner's a really good director. I mean, if you look at his overt, it's like
he can be very effective.
Yeah,
I'm gonna say let's say that. Don't go crazy.
This is Spinal Tap.
Well, that's actually like too perfect.
He directed Stand By Me. He directed The Princess Fucking Bride. He directed A Few Good Men, which is sick.
A Few Good Men is so sick.
Dude, he's
Spinal
awesome.
Spinal Tap, Stand By Me, Princess Bride, Misery, Few Good Men.
I recommend it.
Fucking roll up Misery. My third, and it comes from Wong Kar-wai, Days of Being Wild. There is this thing with characters from Wong Kar-wai movies. I know we didn't get to talk about As Tears Go By before, but having watched it and then after having watched this, he really has a soft spot for these like characters of these dudes who are like shitheads. So Wong Kar-wai is when he's in his shit, there are a few directors that I think I enjoy more. And Days of Being Wild is up there for me. Yeah, this guy is, he's a shitbag. He was adopted by this like rich auntie character, and then he like goes through his life being like irresponsible and like filing through women, and he always has the burden, the chip on his shoulder of wanting to know who his original birth mother is, and that kind of propels him through the film. And he meets a untimely demise because of it, because he also just thinks he can get away with anything. It's just a like one of kind of low-key a perfect film. Wong Kar-wai gets it, and he knows how to do it. And then having watched As Tears Go By before, this kind of like uncompromising sense of certain subsect of masculinity that is something you don't really see anymore, and it just ends up being like this beautiful, to me it's like not a caricature of masculinity, it's just like this is what it is. And I think he does that better than most people.
Yeah. What was most striking was the look and the pacing of the movie is really unique. Yeah. It's like got this throwback to the 50s and 60s in terms of framing and sort of like very modern editing techniques, sort of jarring and confusing at times.
Yeah,
but you piece it together. The editing is very inspired in this movie.
Yeah.
And all five performances are really great.
They're just all incredible.
My number two choice is Charles Burnett's To Sleep With Anger, a movie that really played with my emotions and sense of fun, actually, in a strange way. I watched it two times within a week.
Sense of fun.
Yeah. I really think it's a really playful movie. I think that this is a horror movie, 100%.
I will say this. It's amongst my favorite genres of movie. Outsider, an interloper, comes in and fuck shit up.
It revolves around a family in South Central Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And Danny Glover is like a distant relative. And he shows up on their door one day. They haven't seen him for 30 plus years. And they welcome him in, like families want to do, against their better judgment. And he sort of overstays.
Despite knowing all the like terrible stories about
him. He's got a very dark reputation, which learn as it unfolds throughout the film. And he comes in.
That it's like really dark.
Really dark. He overstays his welcome. It's really this guy comes in to this home with just a certain kind of energy, festers, and just fucks everything.
That's the main thing, is the energy, but also fucking witchcraft.
Oh, he's evil.
He's doing witchcraft.
He's straight up.
Like, dude, he's fucking with chickens in the backyard.
Dude, I mean, the scene where he's clipping his toenails, where he asks the guy to get him the newspaper, the son to get him the newspaper,
yeah,
so he
yeah,
can clip his toenails yeah, on it. I'm yeah, just like, oh my God.
His performance is out of control. It's my problem with that movie is that I think it tries to do just a little bit too much in terms of like the family dynamics and like just trying to like cover a lot of different, because then there's like a, you know, there's like that brother and brother rivalry. There's a lot going on in that movie. So, and then the father's sick.
I think you're going to see it again someday and you're going to really enjoy it.
Yeah, but fucking Danny Glover. Outstanding work.
The film is To Sleep With Anger, and it's very much worth your time. Check it out.
It absolutely is. So my number one and my number two go hand in hand. And my number two is an incredibly beautiful and heartbreaking documentary by the name of The Salt Mines, directed by Susan Aiken. It is 45 minutes long, and it has to do with basically gay and trans women and men living in the salt mines, which are on the west side of Manhattan, not far from the meatpacking district. The salt mines were essentially abandoned salt trucks that would give salt in the winter. They live there, and they basically formed a community that was built upon trust and understanding, and it was a lot of just basically
compassion.
Like, compassion, yeah, and just like
in the same way that we talked about Close Up, I think it's just another beautiful example of humanity at its finest and people who are facing horrific odds. This is also during the AIDS crisis and where people are getting sick left and right, just coming together and just being kind to one another,
looking out for each other, holding each other down, you know, like, girl, do you have condoms for tonight? Just things like that, where it's just like, we're all looking out for each other. Oh, I have money. I can buy an outfit. You can borrow it. Then also like I have enough money for some crack. It's an incredible film. And it's a companion piece to my number one, but is it your number one too?
Yeah, it's my number one too.
The Salt Mines, besides Goodfellas, the real number one of 1990, neck and neck. That would be Jenny Livingston's fucking Paris Is Burning, which is just simply, I don't know how to explain it. Burning is basically the Paris Is Burning is basically the impetus of all things that all, and I'm no offense to you, Jake, but like white people or anybody who is not like black, Hispanic, etc., know about like gay culture and the best, I mean, like just and balls, which are like, you know, been a part of the culture for a hundred, for a long time, and it's explained in the movie, which is was basically like gay Olympic. You know what I mean? Like just like the best thing ever. Paris is Burning is like the blueprint for, I don't know, at this point, most culture. Not even like straight, it's just like most culture. Because straight people watch RuPaul's Drag Race. That's what that is. Paris is Burning is one of the finest living documents of gay culture, black culture, Hispanic culture, ball culture, music, trans culture. I don't know. It's just like, what doesn't it cover? Paris is Burning is monumental film, the likes of which to this day still hasn't kind of been touched. Paris is Burning, Goodfellas, Wild at Heart. Like maybe let's give that. Like
Those are
that
probably the
like that
three.
trio. Fuck it. Like that's that let that be the trio. Three perfect era defining films, you know, that are just magnificent. I don't know. How you feel, dude?
I'm feeling so hungry, bro.
Eat some food.
I need to go get some food.
Oh God. You need to go get some food?
What are you gonna do? You gonna sleep? You gonna keep going?
Oh no, I'm gonna have more drinks.